Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about cybersecurity and technology news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take to the office to help protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
So, there are internet-connected adult toys. Given that we're talking about the Orb networks and Chinese adversaries that like to use IoT devices, what do you think the chances of any given one being part of one of their networks?
Pretty high, because I think the CIA are starting to use those as honey traps.
They're bugged.
All right, first article. Chinese linked hacking units increasingly use orbs to obfuscate espionage, researchers say. Researchers say or analysts say, do you really have to, is that really a stipulation you have to put in the headline anyway? It's just one of those things that just annoys me.
Well, how else would you know? They're appealing to authority.
Oh, yeah, because the researchers are obviously correct. Good point. And you need that in your headlines, because if they just said, if that wasn't there, I wouldn't have even read the article.
That's right.
And this comes to us from CyberScoop. And what's going on is APTs that have been linked to China are shifting their infrastructure to Internet of Things devices and virtual private servers in order to make it harder to track and block their infrastructure. So this is not new traffic, but supposedly it is, according to the article, for these actors.
Yeah, which I did some research because I was thinking about this. I was like, man, I feel like I've seen this before. I did find two other items on this. There's previously Russian-linked actors have been documented using this type of infrastructure, specifically APT-28 from 2018. And this bugs me. The report said that it's new for these actors, but if you actually pivot it into the Mandiant report that this is based off of, the Mandiant report says that they have been using versions of this back to 2016. So this isn't even new to this actor. The Cyber Scoop, I thought this was a legitimate news source that you could believe.
It really depends on your definition of new. 2016 is less than a decade ago.
That's fair. Fake news.
Yeah, maybe the name Orb is new. That's what they're saying. So Orb is Operational Relay Box Networks. So they say that they're built and administered by independent entities, contractors, administrators within China, but used by government-controlled hacking units. Love that, hacking units. Great name.
Yeah. Just hordes of people in dark hoodies.
Yeah, and they got rank patches on their hoodies.
That's actually hilarious. Like the slouch caps the military has. Yeah.
You
got there.
But each actor doesn't maintain their own infrastructure. These independent entities own and control the infrastructure that the actors just use it. Which is one of those things where, according to the U.S., all computer users in China are Chinese, which makes them all an arm of the government. There are no independent people in China.
Nope. So
the article goes on to say that the VPS server, which is the controller, is similar to a method used by Tor.
Well, so what they have is the VPS controller is in China, and that is what is used by, what is administered by the independent contractor. And it's weird. They called them independent contractors and they called them administrators. Like some Chinese citizen administrator just suddenly decides to stand up some infrastructure for attacking the capitalists out of the goodness of their heart. Although actually, maybe that's a reference to criminal actors rather than contractors, maybe. But they set up a VPS server in China, and then that's where the network is administered. And that's where the attackers in China will then enter the network through a Tor node in at least one of the examples. And looking at the way the networks are described, it actually does remind me a lot of Tor, where there's a whole bunch of nodes that are controlled by a bunch of different people. And you just go to the one that you wanted to go to, and it pops you out the other end, and you don't necessarily know where you're coming out from.
Yeah, it's like a mix between Tor and VPN providers.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And I misspoke there. I said you don't even know where you pop out from, but that's not true. You do know where you can select where you're going to pop out from. So they also have the ability to do that, which is helpful to them, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would assume so. But what something that stood out to me in the summary was that Mandiant assesses with, and this is a quote from the article, Mandiant assesses with moderate confidence that this is an effort to raise the cost of defending an enterprise's network and shifts the advantage towards espionage operations by evading detection and complicating attribution. So they're giving a confidence assessment on the motivation of the actor, not on the actions they're taking. And the motivation that they're talking about that they only have a moderate confidence in is what is true of all hackers, which is evading detection. They should have supremely high confidence that that's true because all hackers or attackers attempt to avoid detection.
Maybe the attackers just found that it was cheaper to do it this way.
That's certainly possible. Because really what we're talking about is something that's been done forever, which is compromising one box to leapfrog from that box into another box.
Nobody's ever done this before.
Where you're coming from.
No, you know better than that. Nobody's ever done this before. This is completely new.
Yeah, brand new. Less than a decade old. So one of the things that they harp on a lot in the article or in the paper is the declining value of IP addresses as IOCs. You know, is it worth blocking IP addresses? And how long is that block worth?
So, and this is interesting to me because when I read this, like that was my assumption. My assumption was like, oh, you know, they're only using these IPs for like an hour or a day. Like, because especially with all the harping, like you just said, on how the value is declining. But then when I read the report said the shortest lifespan they've seen is 31 days. That is way longer than I expected. They said some of these networks have 200,000 IP addresses in them. Why aren't you rotating them like on a daily basis?
Yeah, I think this might be, even though this has been happening for almost a decade, it might be a matter of maturity. Because I tell you what, if I was on this project, it would be 31 today, but I would be working towards dynamic instruction and usage of orbs, right? So you'd have an infrastructure set up where you just, anybody who wants to use the infrastructure, they just type in the number of nodes that they need, the country where they want them to go from, and they hit go. And it builds the orb network on the fly. It's cancer victims, compromises victims, builds the orb. You execute the attack, and then you clean up or abandon the orb behind you. And that's it. So one-time use, fire and forget type of system.
You know, if they have 200,000 IPs in that work, that probably works. They probably don't need to reuse the IPs, honestly.
Yeah, and new vulnerable systems are coming online every day.
Also true. Yeah, they could constantly be dumping old ones and bringing, like after it's used in the attack, they dump it off the network or they only use it as an intermediary node?
No, a single use. Once you've
single
used
use.
It, consider it as compromising it, then dump it.
Interesting. That is aggressive.
That's the way I would run it anyway.
That would make it very difficult to track. That is fair.
Yeah, and if you can do it, why not?
Yeah. I mean, you could just do it programmatically, so that makes a lot of sense. So my first thought on this was not quite so on the attacker side, building a more effective way to do it. My thought was on the defense side, when do you stop blocking IPs? So 31 days. 31 days, I think it still provides value to block an IP address, especially if they're not rotating, you know, on a daily or even per attack basis like you're talking about. At what point in time do you think it does make sense to stop blocking IP addresses? Once it gets down to a day, like, because then, you know, maybe it comes in overnight. The analyst sees it, they go to block it, but it's already been, you know, 12 hours, 18 hours since it was used.
I don't know. I mean, standard place that I've been is 30 to 90 days is what I've seen in the past. And, you know, and if there's any kind of service or something you could subscribe to that will provide feedback on them, you could use that service to dynamically decide what you're going to block. Because it could be that you just have default block for 90 days and like a service like Mandiant or whatever says, okay, well that IP is no longer compromised. Meaning you can forego blocking at if you're at day 60, maybe forego block in the last month. But I would say it, as long as your system can support the length of the list that you create, as long as you are eventually aging them out, I don't see any reason why you couldn't pick any date that you think is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole reason that TIPS have IOC age out stuff built into them anyway.
That makes a lot of sense. I do think that one of the things that you definitely want to do on this is don't waste your analyst time manually blocking these. Get this automated. Get this in the ticket so that when you close the ticket, you know, if you close it as a true positive, it automatically pulls those malicious indicators out and sends them to someone to be blocked, or even better, goes directly via API and blocks them.
Right. And automate the aging out also, because you want to have to remember to go back and say, oh, wait, has it been 90 days? I need to go back and clean up those IPs.
Yeah, that would be trouble.
Yeah, the way that I've done it programmatically at another office was we had just a single IP list, and it was created new every day. And then the IPs that were over 90 days old simply weren't added to the newly created list. And then you just updated that list constantly, and the IPs just fell off that list.
Some I've encountered at least one product that does not include aging. It was a proxy. It did not include aging of indicators when you block them, domains specifically. So you had to maintain an external, some sort of external method to age your indicators, which was very frustrating.
Yeah. We kept it was just a flat file. I'm not sure it was a...
That sucks.
It may have been a SQL database, but it had the IOC and then the date the IOC added. And then when the new list was created, it checked the date that the IOC was added. And if it was over 30 days, I think it was, then that IP was just not added to the newly created list.
Yeah.
And then it was also removed from the file.
Makes a lot of sense. It's the next one mine. Did I miss it?
Yeah, it is.
Where are we?
The article quoted.
Oh, okay. So this article had a quote from an analyst at Mandiant, Michael Raggi, and I wanted to add this whole paragraph because this was...
But he's the one that wrote the paper.
Oh, he's the one that wrote the paper? Okay, yeah. So they just pulled this straight out of the paper then.
Yeah.
So the quote is, quote, "Rather than waiting to be reactive or responsive to block each IP as an indicator of compromise, you should be trying to look at the patterns of infrastructure that they're registering, what types of routers they're compromising, what ports and services do you know they're coming from. This way you have a profile of activity to look for, something to create behavioral-based rules for now, rather than just relying on indicators of compromise or blocking in a one-off." That is absolutely correct, and that is also absolutely out of reach of 90% of companies out there doing security. So, I mean, I guess this is actually just a cloaked sales call for people to reach out to Mandiant and pay for them to do this.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But I don't know. I kind of see that statement as a bait and switch also. Because he's saying, you know, don't look for IPs, but look for ports and services. Well, that's just another type of IOC. And,
yeah, and
you
like,
know, and a port or a service isn't necessarily bad. What he's saying is, don't look for these IOCs, look for these IOCs.
And not only that, he's also saying, like, look for these patterns of, like, which routers. I mean, is there even a way to check, like, every IP that hits your network? Oh, this is from a small home router. We should block it. I don't see that there's any reasonable way for a company to be able to identify that on an ad hoc basis as stuff hits your network. But
no, I mean, if something becomes part of an incident or maybe an alert, then you send it off to domain tools. And then maybe you have an automation that gives a deep dive on the register and domain tools.
Sure. Yeah.
To dig that out.
Yeah. And you can use like IP quality score or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll come back and say like, oh, this is residential. And then you can be like, oh yes, well, residential. It's a router of some sort. But then you've got to scan it and try and do some like in-map style identification, you know, grabbing the banner, trying to identify what it is. Yeah, this is very annoying. I did not like this.
So additionally, the article calls out that attributing can't be done by network infrastructure.
I thought that was dead a long time ago. I mean, that being said, I don't think I've ever gone up against an APT, so I don't know. Maybe they were using longer lasting networks.
I don't know. From a typical defender standpoint, though, who cares? I don't care about attribution.
Honestly, yeah, most companies should ignore. It's never been something where I felt like I had to know, oh no, we're being hit by APT 28.
The cost-benefit ratio is simply not there for attribution for most organizations. I mean, the government, I'm sure they feel the need to do it. But typical company is not going to have any real necessity for attribution. If it comes down to a court case, attribution is going to be figured out by the cops.
Yeah, I mean, although for some reason, it really makes leadership really happy if they feel like they've got somebody to
point the finger at.
Blame, yeah.
Well, I guess you might want to do attribution if you want to be able to defend the fact that you failed to say that, oh, we were attacked by an APT, we can possibly defend against it. Maybe you want to do attribution in that case, like Sony.
Makes sense. All right. They did mention that you can choose IP addresses that you can use that are geographically close to whoever you're targeting. I have seen that occasionally in the past using VPNs, although I don't know if that was on purpose or not. It's entirely likely that even a criminal using a random output on a VPN is going to sometimes, you know, end up in a neighboring city. Right. But I can definitely see where having that true all the time would be very frustrating, because when you're reviewing an account for malicious logins, you're looking for, you know, weird geolocated IP addresses. You're looking for different IP addresses than normal, although that one's tough because, you know, they go to a coffee shop or something, or they're in the office or out of the office. Their own IP address cycles, can't rely on that. You look for different user agents. You look for different weird hours of logging in outside of working hours. Although again, with these days where people are expected to answer email at all times a day, maybe that's not a great way. But I can see somebody building a better phishing kit. And I'm wondering if this already exists, because this does not seem like this is that much of a brilliant move on my part. But I'm imagining a phishing kit that, you know, you set up a landing page, someone hits it, they sign in, it records the browser agent, the time of login, the source IP address. Probably measures the type of the device that it's logging in from. And then when the attacker pivots, you choose your VPN or your orb network. You find an exit IP as close as possible geographically, which again, with the Internet of Things, like, can you imagine if they own the router in your own home? They're like, oh, wow, I can log in from the same IP address.
Right.
Maybe we should do something about that. Maybe we should be like watching their traffic directly. And then the attacker can, you know, choose to hit during normal working hours. They can automatically edit the browser agent so it matches the person. And now it's coming from the same geolocated area. And now it's very difficult to detect through behavior-based rules, unless you've got something like Intune on the devices or certificate-based authentication.
And if they're doing a little bit deeper dive too than simply, you know, mimicking the browser, but actually coming up with what the device fingerprinting would look like.
Yeah, like the cookies and the other stuff that the various places use to...
Right. You know, when you log into some sites, this is actually typical for a lot of banking sites, where they'll say, you know, remember this device or remember this system. You check that checkbox. So that's sending fingerprint information for your system back to the organization. So if they were to capture that same data and be able to mimic that back when they connect also, that's another thing that they could do in order to further obfuscate, you know, the fact that they aren't who you think they are, or that they're someone you should trust when the connection happens.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're already doing that, right? With the session stealing, the cookie stealing. So just grab all the information from the browser they can. Try to steal the cookie. If that fails, then they try and log on, you know, trying to match it as closely as possible, hoping not to trigger MFA. I actually don't know if MFA is smart enough. I don't know how the workings of it. So I'm not 100% sure if this would trick MFA or not. I'd like to think the people that work on that are smarter than me and have already thought of that.
Sure.
They probably have, hopefully. So this is, as I mentioned before, this is some criminal level separation, which is kind of a funny thing to say, but we've already seen the criminals get very specialized in specific ways. And now I'm wondering if we are going to see more of this on the APT side, although maybe this already has. I know our government is very specialized and, you know, has dozens of different contractors that specialize in stuff. But I'm curious about how they choose which orb infrastructure to use. Do they have, like, some of them faster, have more bandwidth? Are some of them prioritized more towards reliability? When you're bouncing between, I mean, I don't know if you've used Tor. I've tried to use Tor a couple times. It's a pain. It's kind of slow. I imagine, especially since they're using compromised devices, the reliability is probably not great.
Well, it could be that they rate each individual device, and then if you and then the quality when you build the orb, because you imagine that when at least this is the way I would think is that when they compromise a device, that device compromise doesn't automatically tie it to a specific orb. It's just a device that's available to be connected to an orb. So maybe they build the orb based on the attributes of the devices that are compromised.
Or slightly different because of the types of devices it includes.
Right. So
and therefore is used
devices
for a different...
that have higher bandwidth or more processing power may be shunted off to or attached to a very specific high value orb, and ones that aren't are low value ones, or, you know, they have different types of orbs based on what they've got available.
Be interesting. Yeah, like selecting arrows from a quiver in a Green Arrow movie or something. Like, this is the
right
one that does this.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the one that does this and pops out in Gary, Indiana.
Pops out in Gary, Indiana. It's always Gary, Indiana.
Better than East St. Louis.
Yeah. I have to imagine that these contractors probably would start selling this access to criminals as well. Or maybe they started off working with criminals. But there's a couple of pros to this. More money. There's more camouflage for the APT. Is it a criminal or an APT coming out of this exit node if they start identifying these orb networks? Of course, there's also some cons. The more the network gets used, the more attention it draws. If there's a bunch of criminals coming out of it, then people might notice it and block it before the APT actually uses it. But I don't know. I guess it depends on how greedy they get.
But who's to say this is not happening already? Well, it could be that these orbs are already being sold on the dark web. I don't know. Because you're
Seems
dealing
fair.
With, and this is another quote from the paper, you're dealing with a dedicated entity whose sole job it is to maintain a vast array, different types of compromised routers, and just for the purpose of renting those out, that someone can try and access your environment with them. So I think the fact that he says for the purpose of renting out, maybe may already know or assume that these are actually part of criminal infrastructures that can be rented. And another quote from the paper is, these networks are not controlled by APT actors using them, but rather are temporarily used by these APT actors. So who knows? You could search the dark web and see if you can find advertisements for it or not.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually, with some of the way, like we talked about this briefly before, some of the way they phrase some of the stuff earlier, where they said contractors and administrators, that does seem to go with that, where it's not just where they are renting from an actual criminal.
Right. And this is part of the other annoying part, like I mentioned earlier, is that we have to stop treating all actors in a country that's, you know, chosen by the United States government as an enemy to be an arm of the government of that foreign country.
Yep.
You know, some may be tied to the government, some may be independent criminals, some may be part-time government employees, part-time criminals, or some may be like the mafia that will, you know, generally act to their own best interest, but occasionally will do stuff from the government when the government twists their arm. You know, kind of like the mob in the U.S. during World War II and for a few decades afterwards was very much like that, where they were another part of the government, just about doing things on behalf of the government.
Yeah, from the perspective of a company, like, they're all trying to break in. You can treat them all the same.
Right. The reason this is important is that this piles on the idea that Threat Intel really needs to do more than just throw IOCs around. You know, if Threat Intel was able to say, okay, what are the most attacked IoT devices? Who sell those? Who sells those? Who's using those? Does a certain ISP use a highly attacked modem? And are we seeing attacks from those ISPs or something like that?
So
that could
be
something useful from Threat Intel versus just providing an IP address.
Yeah, and it'd be really nice to have the context around them too. Like, this is something that drives me nuts all the time working in the SOC. You get, you know, you've got your IOCs being fed into your TIM and you get an alert that says this IP address was bad. And you don't get any you don't get any context from the original source. And you've got to kind of go out and look yourself and, you know, troll through the list and try and find it.
When it did say IP bad, botnet
Yeah, well, IP bad orb network would be useful. Like, you're like, all right, so this is probably an IoT device. You know, it may be a legitimate resident. It may be a bad guy. It may be a criminal. It was picked up, you know, 27 days ago. Mm-hmm. All right, it may be reaching the end of its lifetime. Stuff like IP quality score. I think it's time I mentioned that this one. They do a good job of adding a fraud score. They specialize in watching for more commercial fraud, but they'll put like, you know, recent abuse scene, and they'll put, you know, what their confidence level is and whether it's a VPN or a Tor node. I'd be interesting if they added an orb. I don't know how they, I feel like a lot of this stuff that you're talking about here with the most attacked IoT devices and who sells them and who uses them, that's kind of out of scope of the average security team. The average security team needs to know this is part of an orb network. You know, other folks have seen malicious traffic from it recently, you know, within these dates.
Well, I think if you have a threat intel team, though, they could do this level of research in order to find the networks.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Or the IPs that could be part of the orb network, because, you know, this network has a lot of IoT devices that are typically attacked by the orb network.
So that would actually be really interesting. We've talked a lot about risk-based alerting. I don't know if this is even reasonable to do, but that would be an interesting bit. If you get a communication that's flagged for some other reason, and then look at the, you know, maybe hit it back with a quick MMAP scan or look at other enrichment sources, probably not a MMAP scans, I think, are generally considered legal, or hit it against some of those other enrichment sources we're talking about, and then assign a risk score based on that. But again, like, if they get to the point where you're talking about where they're flipping it daily or each attack, then all of a sudden all that becomes useless.
Wow. Yeah, of course. Ew. I mean, anybody who would be attacked by me would be, you know, in serious trouble. But anyway, but if you tie this in, you know, because what you do is you get, you know, if you also have a, you know, a subscription to Shodan, then you can get reports from Shodan on what that device might be, or you may know from a Shodan scan what that device is already to realize that it is a typically compromised IoT device.
Yeah, that would be interesting to assign risk scores to like every incoming IP address. You'd have to, that would require some bandwidth and some processing power though.
Depends on your volume, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I know some of the big internet companies with giant websites that have hundreds of servers behind them, they're doing that sort of thing. But yeah.
But like I said, what you could do about it is, you know, have a Shodan subscription, have a domain tool subscription, and start writing some automated scripts in order to do some of this analysis for you.
Yeah. You do not want to have your analysts be doing this manually. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be doing it, them doing it 5 years ago, and you definitely don't want to be doing it in a year or two when the bad guys listened to this podcast and picked up on what David's putting down. Start changing each time.
You know, you might do it manually once or twice to get a feel for what the process looks like. But definitely, if you're going to scale this to make it useful, you're going to have to automate.
Yep. All right. Second article for today. The privacy implications of tracking wireless access points from Schneier. He linked to a article that was written based on a paper, which made it sound much worse than it actually is.
In our opinion, anyway.
In our opinion, yeah. So I'm going to start with their own summary, since I didn't want to try and rewrite it to avoid plagiarism. So I'm just going to put quotes around it and copy and paste it here. Quote, Wi-Fi-based positioning systems are used by modern mobile devices to learn their position using nearby Wi-Fi access points as landmarks. End quote. This is all about the alternative to GPS, because GPS power consumption tends to be higher, so mobile devices are relying on WPS instead more these days. GPS is still used occasionally, and when it's used, they actually, both Apple and Google, scan for nearby Wi-Fi basic service set identifiers and then report those to Apple Google. So when your phone uses GPS, you're feeding the Wi-Fi positioning system as well. So other devices that have GPS turned off can now receive those results. So these work by looking at detected BSS IDs, and then they query the database and say, hey, I'm seeing this BSS ID. Tell me where you have seen this at. And it will then return GPS coordinates that it's been seen at. That's why frequently if you're not using GPS and you look at your phone, there's a circle around it on the map that says, you know, you're somewhere within this area. That's because that is the area that BSS ID has been seen at.
Yeah, because it also gives up the power level.
Yeah,
so to give you an idea about your distance from wherever that BSS ID is.
Yeah, I imagine it does some degree of triangulation with the multiple BSS IDs that it sees.
Mm-hmm. Got, yeah. I mean, that's probably why they can get down to so close if that power analysis is really good. Because if you end up being in the center of, you know, 10 BSS IDs, they probably have a pretty good indication of where you're at.
Yeah, I was at a restaurant yesterday and I got that little uncertainty circle. And I mean, it got the restaurant I was at. It did not get the seat I was sitting at. The seat I was sitting by the window and I was a little bit outside of the circle. But
and that's why the sniper missed.
Close enough for a bomb strike, yeah. So this Apple likes to make things easier and more useful to the phone. When you send one of these queries up to the API for Apple, they will return up to 400 other BSS IDs that they have seen nearby and their locations as well. This is, generally speaking, good for the user because now the user in the phone doesn't have to make multiple queries. They only had to query once and they, you know, can keep walking and before they have to query again. But it makes surveillance and discovery a lot more easier because it turns out you only have to know one BSS ID in an area to start with, and then Apple will helpfully feed you a whole bunch of other ones. That is super helpful, though.
Yeah, well, if they don't get the distance between you and the BSS ID, then that's still not going to improve the accuracy a whole lot, is it?
Well, what they're talking about here now is they're not talking about the accuracy of that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that how that all blends together. They're just talking about using this as a discovery mechanism to just try and find all the BSS IDs.
Right.
Yeah. So Google and Apple make these Wi-Fi positioning systems public, which makes sense. You know, they both make phones. They use this on their phones, but they allow other people to use it too, applications and other devices. So they do it a little bit differently. I found out as I was reading the paper that the reason that they chose to use Apple for this is because Apple's API is free. They let anybody use it. You do not need an API key. There is apparently very little in the way of quality or content checking or any kind of rate limiting on this. So they were able to, they did this because they could download millions and millions of BSS IDs very quickly. Google charges, that's not much, it's like $5 per like 5,000 queries or something like that. So it's not too expensive, but it is expensive enough to keep them from doing this. But as it turns out, you don't have to prove that you're seeing what you're seeing. You just ask the API for a BSS ID and it will tell you the location. They focused on Apple because, as I mentioned, there's no auth, there's no controls. But it kind of makes sense from the perspective of an engineering team. The engineering team wants to make this as simple and as easy as possible so that all of their customers can easily perform these lookups. So to prove their point, they have three different use cases. First one was actually they have four different use cases, sorry. Estimating damage from Maui wildfires. They took a look at the BSS IDs. They were doing this experiment during the Maui wildfires because they did find that the information that Apple has is updated after about a week. They put up a new BSS ID and they waited to see how long before it would appear in the data set. And it took about a week to be added to the data set. It also takes about a week to be removed from the data set after it's no longer seen. So they were able to go in and check the BSS IDs available in Maui, both before and after the wildfires. And then they mapped those locations onto a map and then matched it against the damage estimates, the maps showing where the most damage was. And they found that it worked out pretty quickly. They were able to get a pretty accurate idea of the most damaged parts of Maui because the most damaged parts of Maui were the same parts that had the BSS IDs disappeared. Therefore, the wireless networks disappeared and probably the houses as well.
Could be.
Yeah, or people moved out too. It could not necessarily mean the house disappeared.
It ran away.
People left. Yeah. So,
yeah, because I know my router's in my go bag.
Yeah, they suggested that this might be useful to estimate damage from, I was thinking from a military strike, but they were talking about from disasters and other things as well. You can assume that if an SSID goes away, then the people may not be dead, but they might be injured or they might have just left. So it's not a very accurate method of assessing damage.
Well, I mean, also you don't know the people count for an SSID. you just know that you got one SSID in the house.
Yeah.
Or maybe you've got three or four in that same house and, you know, one guy or maybe you've got one and you've got a half a dozen people in that.
Yeah, I've got four in my household right now. Probably more, actually. I mean, because they talk about later, some IoT things create their own Wi-Fi spots. So there's four that I know about, but might be more.
Yes. And the Chinese have asked you to put up a couple more.
They just sent me this laptop and they told me to just lock it in a drawer and don't pay any attention to it. I figure it's harmless.
Is that you heard about the North Koreans that were using people to get jobs?
It wasn't actually that. This was somebody. I was reading an article in, I think, I don't remember which magazine. It was one of the political ones. I get, you know, we've talked about this before. I get a conservative and a liberal and a libertarian political magazine. And one of them was talking about a book review of some guy who was a publicist for the worst people in the world. Like, he represented like Libya and like the Saudi government and folks like that. And it mentioned that he had been arrested because one of the people that he worked with from one of these countries had asked him, had given him a bunch of money and given him a laptop and told him to just, you know, turn on the laptop and lock it in a drawer and just let it run. And he did, and the FBI came looking and came knocking on his door.
Oh, no, there's something else that came out that North Koreans were applying for jobs in the United States.
Yeah,
they needed to make it look like they were in the U.S. So they'd use a cutout.
That woman in Arizona.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so they use that cutout in order to get the job. And then when the company sent the laptop out for that remote worker who they thought was in Arizona, they would send it to the address in Arizona. And she would plug it in and turn it on. And then they'd VPN into it from North Korea. Yes. And then connect into the corporate networks from the laptop in Arizona.
Yeah, I saw that the other day. I tried to get in on that, but...
Very enterprising, because the deal was that whoever they hooked up with, they would get a percentage of the salary that they were making.
Yeah, I'll take an extra $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
Let that thing heat up my house a little bit. I needed $1,000 a month because of the extra air conditioning bills.
Well, imagine that you've got five or six of those.
Yeah.
That you're getting $1,000 a month from.
Yeah.
Pretty good business.
I'm surprised, given how many people act as cutouts already for criminals, that they didn't have just a whole bunch of people across the U.S. that were just happy to let folks do that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my second call then would be to the FBI, and I would go ahead and be like, hey, guys, for $1,000, I'll let you put a bug on my...
I'll let you eavesdrop on this laptop.
Yeah, we'll just put a span port here on the thing, and you guys can just get all their transmissions and... then I get paid twice.
Yep, double
agent. Probably sell it to MI6 too.
You might have to sell it to MI6 first, so then the NSA can say they weren't getting it from the U.S. citizens directly.
Hmm. You probably pay double that way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, second use case. They tracked users in Russia based on BSS IDs seen, but they both looked at Russian and Ukrainian side. The Russian side, they were watching for BSS IDs that started somewhere other than Ukraine and then ended up in Ukraine. And they saw what they thought were aid workers moving into the Ukraine that were coming from European countries. They saw a lot of folks from St. Petersburg and Moscow and a couple other places going to Ukraine. What I find really interesting about this, I'm surprised that they saw so much. Dave and I were talking before we started recording, and we were kind of laughing about how, like, people don't pick up and take their routers with them. But apparently a lot of people do in European countries.
Yeah, it could be a thing for overseas. It's just not something that happens in the United States much.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll talk about more about this later. I just realized that I have a note about this and several lines down, so I'm jumping the gun. So we'll get back to that
typical,
in a minute.
Typical man.
I know. So Ukraine apparently does use Starlink extensively. There's been a lot of talk, you know, before earlier in the war about Elon Musk providing Starlink for them. And apparently at the Starlink terminals, the way that Starlink works is it's a router that connects to Starlink and you connect your computer to the router. Your computer does not connect directly to the Starlink satellite. So they were able to track these Starlink terminals and they were able to see that they were geographically limited to the territory that Ukraine currently controls, which is part of the deal. I actually think that this would be a really interesting case where you could really kind of screw with the Ukrainians if you, you know, had an in with Elon or some other provider, and you would get them to actually be like, you know what? No, you can use them wherever you want to. and then track where they were like moving to. Like all of a sudden now you see Starlink, you know, terminals popping up behind your lines and you're like, oh, Ukraine uses this pretty extensively. I wonder if this is someone trying to, you know, upload their data from a mission or something.
Yeah, because I was thinking that you know, since it's geographically linked to what Ukraine controls, yeah, they're going to have to keep moving that line west.
Yeah, they probably are. Third one was the Hamas war. This one was pretty, like, it was interesting, but it was not terribly surprising. They tracked the number of BSS IDs in Gaza, both before Israel started bombing and turned off the electricity. And I think they said they saw something like a 72% drop in BSS IDs, which is surprising in two ways. Like, number one, that's a lot of BSS IDs that are gone, but that's surprising also that there's that many left. There's still 28% of the BSS IDs in Gaza are still running. Are these people with solar panels or
and have not been hit with a bomb?
That have not yet been hit with a bomb. Yeah, I don't know. Final items that they mentioned as a kind of thing here was China has a law that you can't store BSS IDs. So Apple's database and Google's database, they don't upload Chinese BSS IDs. So that's just a giant blank spot to this database.
Well, that seems like a simple fix then, doesn't it?
More laws. I knew that's what you would come up with, David.
You know, I always like more laws. That's what I think. Anytime someone pisses me off, it's like, there ought to be a law.
Yeah, exactly. So discussion points for here. Number one, this tracks Wi-Fi access points. This does not track your phone. Your phone does have a hotspot, but your phone's hotspot creates a random BSS ID. I looked into this a little bit. Turns out they started this in the mid-2010s or so. So they were concerned about being able to track people based on their BSS ID of their phone hotspot. So they've already implemented a remediation for this. So I was really confused by this. I was surprised at how many people were moving. In the US, at least, frequently your Wi-Fi router comes with your subscription in your house. You don't take your router with you when you leave. It stays with the house if you have only one internet vendor. Or if you have multiple internet vendors, you return it when you leave to the vendor. Yeah, it may not be true in other countries. Maybe you take your router with you wherever you go.
I've moved a couple of times in Virginia, and that's what you do. You go drop it off.
Yep.
At the ISP.
Yep.
Or you mail it back to them, one of the two.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, in recent years, have started to buy my own routers, but yeah, for probably 20 years, I just used the other one. But wait, there's more. Apparently, Rokus create their own Wi-Fi networks. They did specifically comment that Rokus were the number one and the number two BSS ID manufacturers. The BSS ID is just a Mac. So those were the top two manufacturers they saw. So I don't know why a Roku creates a Wi-Fi network, maybe to connect it with the remote?
So the Roku is not asked to, you know, the Roku doesn't connect to an AP?
Sure it still connects to an AP. But it apparently also creates its own as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is very, very interesting. But, you know, actually, I'm looking at my networks in the area right now. So there's a bunch of them that say Fios. That's the provider. But there's a couple of them. There's an NG hub. I don't know what an NG hub is. There's HP setup. I don't know what that is.
NG's Netgear.
Netgear. There are a couple of things around. I've seen some other smart home devices pop up there before. Travel routers. They found a number of Wi-Fi APs that are designed to move, and they could track them around the world. People that use these travel routers, which this is something that's new to me. I've never heard of these before. I looked them up, and they're actually kind of cool. They are a box you plug into a Ethernet port, and then you connect your laptop to the travel router, your phone to the travel router. And the travel routers have a built-in VPN endpoint. Some of them have Tor. Some of them have other like certificate-based security. So everything that you communicate to the travel router is then encrypted over the Ethernet, which is really interesting. But that's a trade-off. You have better comm security to prevent somebody from listening in on you. If you, you know, connect to a hotel Wi-Fi and you accept their certificate and now they can man in the middle of you. But now you can potentially be tracked with those travel routers, although only at a delay, since it takes 7 days to update this.
All right, and you're typically not going to be someplace for, 7 days. So yeah, it'd be 7 days only up, and by the time it's relevant, you're no longer there.
Yep. Yeah, this only matters as if there's some way, some importance that could be ascribed to you being at a specific location.
Like for more than 2 weeks.
Secretary of State. Well, no, even after the fact. Like, they just, there's actually just a discussion around somebody high up on operations from Apple going over to Taiwan to talk to somebody from the chip manufacturer there. And there's a, I saw an article speculating that they were taking over the full 2-nanometer chip. Like, you could potentially do some business espionage style stuff by like watching who goes where.
I see.
Maybe. I don't know.
Or insider trading, maybe.
Ooh, insider trading. Would 7 days give you enough time to get in on that stock? I don't know. So Weigle has been doing this for years. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it. W-I-G-L-E. Is it Wiggle?
I don't know.
It only has one G, though. Yeah, which stands...
So...
Yeah, that's fair. It stands for something. I don't know what it stands for.
Yeah, so it's definitely Wiggle, then.
Definitely Wiggle, then. All right. They've been doing this for years, keeping track of these, but this is a little bit different. It's crowdsourced by people war driving. Apple is way more ubiquitous. There's not very many people war driving these days, although I'm curious actually to know how many folks are. That would be interesting. Stumblers. They have 543,000 people. I'm guessing Stumblers. They have updated 535,000 of these today. That's really fascinating. There's still people going around trying to do this just for fun.
Well, maybe that these people just keep it running in their car.
Yeah, then, I have seen some people do that, yeah.
And they don't even really think about it anymore. It's just a thing that they do, and then they download it when they get home or whatever.
Yeah. But Apple's way more ubiquitous. It said there's 543,000 Stumblers. There's millions and millions and millions of people with Apple phones.
No.
Android phones. Billions. Yeah, you're right. It's more than a million. They did do some cross-checking, and they found that Wiggle did have some APs that were not in Apple, which was really a surprise. It was about 10% of their query. They didn't provide the opposite. They didn't see if there were any in Apple that weren't in Wiggle, because I imagine that number would be a lot higher than 10%. In terms of remediation, they proposed the following three things. Apple should rate limit queries. API manufacturers should randomize the BSS ID each time it's rebooted. That's already implemented in phones, so it's totally doable. And users, if you think someone would track you, don't move your Wi-Fi devices. Abandon them and purchase a new one.
Leave it on the side of the road and do the abandonment too.
Yeah. If your AP allows it, set it to randomize BSS ID. It's probably really the, like, I'm thinking about getting one of these travel routers now. These look kind of cool. Not that anybody's looking at me or watching anything, but.
Oh, that's cool, what you technique. Think.
That's what I think. All right. So why does this matter? Well, it mostly doesn't, it turns out. This is a lot less than it seemed when we initially read it. But if you are using something like travel routers or anything like this for your executives, I should probably take a look at protecting them from being followed 7 days later.
Do you know, does anybody use classified communications?
I don't think you can you?
I don't know. I was just thinking about, you know, putting something on a drone and flying around and seeing if any of there's ad hoc wireless networks in the middle of nowhere that's coming from a olive green tent or something.
Oh, interesting. Using it for intelligence collection instead of for tracking people. Mm-hmm. Looking for stuff like, oh, the government, you know, buys this type of modem and here's a cluster of BSS IDs that are all from this type of modem in this nondescript building in the middle of Minneapolis or something.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of what we were talking about with the Orb network, where certain types of devices are being compromised, but that doesn't mean all those devices are compromised. They're just more likely to be.
Mm-hmm.
You could do like some behavioral style detections.
Yeah, it's a percentage.
Yeah.
Or a confidence score, however you want to put it.
You know what? You probably could, because there's probably a bunch of tells, because they would all be configured in the same way in that area, indicating some type of organization. They might use standard DoD naming conventions as well or something like that. Yeah. I don't know if these things get the regular wire, just the BSS IDs, or if they get the full network name. So might be interesting. So, or if you detect it, you know, on a military base and then suddenly it pops up.
Right.
Yeah. Cause I would bet that war drivers probably circle military bases pretty happily.
Instead, you could use a drone.
Yeah. That'd be faster.
And typically, you know, if this were a thing, they would be conducting military exercises, right? So you could collect them knowing that they're going to leverage them on the installation whenever they're doing an exercise, and then just keep track of those. So when they show up somewhere else, you know exactly where it came from.
This is wild. I'm looking at this wiggle. There are Wi-Fi things detected in the middle of Yosemite National Park, like off the road, like not even anywhere close to like lodges or anything.
Like nature cam kind of stuff, maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Do those like animal cams, like do they set up a network so you can connect to your phone? Because, oh my gosh. All right, this is wild. I have my kids bought me a little like microscope for your phone. And the way that it works is this microscope, it's like the size of your palm. It has a built-in Wi-Fi chip, and to connect to it, you turn it on and it turns on the Wi-Fi, and then you connect your phone to the Wi-Fi, and then you can like use your camera to see what this little microscope thing sees. So yeah, it makes me wonder about how many. I just hit my daily limit on my goal. Boo.
That was fast.
That was fast. I wonder like how much this thing costs to get. Anyways, it just makes me wonder like how many things there are that use Wi-Fi networks for communication that we're probably not even thinking, because this is like a cheap piece of something from, you know, like Alibaba.net or something.
All right. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serenity Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.